All right. Now tell me that didn't have at least 200 of you up jumping around, all right? Because it's got me jumping around. In fact, there's two people holding me down on the seat right now, okay? And one of them is Keanu Williams, who's back engineering the show, which I'm really happy. And Henry Carson is also trying to hold down my feet. I don't know why he's doing that, but we'll get free someday, okay? All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I want to rush into this because we have a whole lot to talk with you about. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing a clip from Bob Avakian, and this clip is called Free Yourself from the GTF, and it's a clip from Avakian's talk, new talk, that the Trump-Pence regime must go, all right? It's got to go, okay? In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And we'll have more about that as we get there. Before that, we'll be running an interview I did with Catherine Joyce, the author of the book Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. It's a book which is being reprinted now because its message has become even more urgent, okay? And everybody can see that. And if you can't see it now, you'll see it after the interview with Catherine. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be bringing you an interview I did just yesterday with Dar Jamail, a longtime investigative reporter known for years of unembedded reporting from Iraq and the Middle East. And he's a Truth Out staff reporter, and he's been writing about the climate for quite some time in a series called Climate Disruption Dispatches. So here's Dar Jamail. And our guest today is Dar Jamail. Dar writes for Truth Out, covering environmental issues, and he's the author of numerous books, including The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And Dar is also the author of the book The End of ICE, forthcoming from the New Press. He lives and works in Washington State. Dar Jamail, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you again, Michael.
Yeah, good to talk with you, man. I got so much to ask you, so I'm just going to jump right into it. You open up your latest piece in Truth Out. You talk about beautiful Lake, is it Chilan?
Correct.
And you talk about how it's really beautiful, it's really something to look at and to put you in wonder of things. But then you counter that with that, actually, though, the water is toxic. And then, just as, you know, as I'm sitting there thinking, oh, man, this is horrible, then you go one step further because then you say, but this pales in comparison to the ongoing and worsening impacts of anthropogenic climate disruption. So I wanted you to first talk about what anthropogenic climate disruption is, and what do you mean it pales in comparison to the ongoing and worsening impacts of that?
So I use the term anthropogenic climate disruption, being acutely aware of writing predominantly for a U.S. audience and the amount of denial, fossil fuel-funded denialism in the country, and because it's the most scientifically accurate and indisputable terminology to use when talking about climate change or global warming. So anthropogenic means human-caused, and climate, everybody knows that, and then disruption, because global warming is inaccurate because it's causing some places to see record cold temperatures, although they're the distinct minority that is happening. In climate change, it's accurate to say, well, yeah, but climate's always changing. So disruption is the most scientifically accurate term because what humans have done by injecting more CO2 into the atmosphere, there's more CO2 in the atmosphere right now than has ever been by far in human existence, obviously directly from fossil fuel emissions, predominantly that is. And so it's disrupting the climate around the globe, which we're seeing. And speaking of high temperatures, across the country, I don't need to talk to you down there in L.A. about that. So I prefer that term, and I use it all the time just to be as accurate as I can. And when I talk about this lake, Lake Chelan in central Washington, rather, on the eastern side of the Cascade Mountain Range, it's the third deepest lake in the country. It's over 1,400 feet deep. It is the deepest spot. It's 55 miles long, and it's polluted by heavy metals from old mining activity. And I mentioned that pales in comparison to the ongoing and worsening impacts of ACD is the acronym I use for anthropogenic climate disruption. It's because of what I mentioned earlier, that there's, you know, we have now well over 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. And the last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, it was another mass extinction event on the planet, if you start going back into geologic time. And the last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, seas were more than 60 feet higher across the globe than they are today. We're on track to see a minimum of 3.5C increase by 2100. There's never been humans on the planet at 3.5C hotter than pre-industrial baseline temperature levels. If you look at a survey across the planet and look at the amount of extreme weather events and droughts and floods and heat records being set, rivers running dry, et cetera, it's clear we are very, very in it deep. And so that's why I mentioned, this one lake, as big as it is, and the sadness and the tragedy of that being polluted with heavy metals from an old mine is hardly a drop in the bucket compared to when we kind of macro out and zoom out and look at what's happening at the hands of humans to the entire planet.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you jump into right away is you talk about two new studies that were investigating corn and vegetables. And then you talk about how it's a warning of an increasing risk of food shocks around the world, along with malnutrition, if this ACD continues unchecked. And how likely is that, that this is going to be able to continue unchecked?
Well, I think just looking pragmatically at the situation in this country with the government, what is the government doing to curb emissions? I don't even need to waste my breath on this station talking about that. We all know they're not doing anything. Instead, they're stomping on the gas pedal like it's never been stomped on before. They're dismembering the EPA. They're cutting all regulations. They're trying to drill anywhere they can as quickly as possible. So that, and then if you look at other countries, even those around the globe that are taking steps, significant steps, some of the EU countries, Costa Rica, et cetera, Ireland just divested from all fossil fuels. I mean, these are obviously very commendable things, but if you look at how far along we already are, for example, 93% of all the heat that humans have generated into the atmosphere has actually been absorbed into the oceans. If this planet didn't have oceans, ambient temperatures in the atmosphere would be 97 degrees hotter than they are right now. Instead, all that heat's in the oceans. You do not get that heat back out of the oceans until thousands and thousands of years pass and we stop immediately on a dime introducing any more human-caused CO2 and methane into the atmospheres. So when and how is that going to happen? When and how is a globally government-coordinated response on the level of all life on Earth is at risk, nothing short of a massive global government reaction to this to stop all emissions except for probably those of hospitals and emergency services and transitioning over into renewables, finding ways to, on a mass scale, sequester, pull CO2 already that's in the atmosphere back out of it. These are the kind of things that need to be happening yesterday. And instead, we don't see anything to indicate that anything like that's even on the drawing boards for the planet. That's why I think when we talk about, like these studies you mentioned, an increase of 4 degrees C, which is the current trajectory, there is nothing to indicate that we will not hit that. And in fact, all of the worst-case Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change scenarios continue to be outpaced by reality. Mm-hmm. So that's why I feel pretty confident in saying that save some incredibly dramatic event coming completely out of left field that would kick in motion some of what I just mentioned as far as coordinated response around the globe to this, it looks like we are absolutely locked in to all of these worst-case scenarios, if not something even worse than that.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's interesting because tied into what you're just saying, it is true that people often talk about this as if it's something that is still in the realm of, well, maybe it could happen. It could happen like this. But, you know, and then you go on and argue that it's already current. And I thought one of the things that really struck me was you have a whole section in this piece that you wrote talking about, you know, the idea that again, this impact on something that people don't even really think about very often in relation to food and the survival, but the impact on the ability of the planet to produce food and the type of food that's like, for instance, corn and things like that are actually eaten by a huge proportion of the population around the world. And if this gets actually severely impacted and to the point where it's dying all over the place, this is a pretty dire situation for the planet and for the people on it.
Well, that's right, and that's why I include this really as the first statistical information in the piece talking about those two new studies on food, and that they just happen to be published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is arguably the most prestigious scientific journal around. It's certainly one of them. No one would argue that. And, we're talking about an increased risk of simultaneous crop failures of the planet's largest corn-growing regions when we see an increase of 4C, which we've already talked about, what I feel like is inevitable at this point. It's not if, but when. Simultaneous to that, the other study talks about the loss of nutrients in critical vegetables. And so even if they're if somehow they manage to keep being produced, there's enough water, droughts are somehow mitigated, et cetera, which also doesn't seem likely, but just even pretend that that's possible, the food that is generated is having significantly less nutrients. So there's that issue. And then the other study pointed to the risk of simultaneous crop failures from U.S., China, Brazil, and Argentina, which are the four biggest corn exporters on the entire planet, that once temperatures hit 4C increase, that risk is approximately an 80% likelihood of that happening, which basically means it's guaranteed. So at some point between now and 2100, that happens. And then how do people react when all of a sudden there's not even half the food availability of a basic staple crop? What does that do to food prices in a country like the United States, where half the adult population is already living weekly on a paycheck-to-paycheck basis? Who's going to be able to afford that?
Mm-hmm. You know, and along the same lines, this is you know, when you're talking about this, and you're talking about even the fact that how much water is actually necessary for this, and what happens that when this keeps going down, there is actually a major change in not only the availability, but also just what happens with the water. You talk about relentless pumping of groundwater to offset lack of snowpack and rainfall due to ACD, and that has a, you know, people, I don't think people really get the connection between the fact that this is happening and, you know, farming and getting what we need to eat, but also the very impact on water itself and the availability of water and what that means for the human existence.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what sets Earth apart from all other planets that NASA's trying to look for signs of life. The first thing you look for is water. And here we are. We have it. And yet we've altered the climate dynamics of the planet enough that right there down there near you guys in the Central Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley, large portions of that area have already sunk 30 feet just since the 1920s because that much groundwater is being sucked out of the aquifers, which are supposed to act as a savings account for water. Normally, with normal rainfall patterns and enough snowpack being, releasing itself out of the mountains under normal temperatures and providing enough water for standard irrigation practices, that's all so disrupted and so behind schedule already, because NASA predicted several years ago that California was essentially entering a multi-decadal mega drought. And we are certainly watching that right now. And again, I don't need to be telling you guys down there about what you're experiencing, but that's the evidence of it, that so much water has been pumped out of a certain area that the USGS calls it the single biggest example of how humans have altered the planet. Is right there from the groundwater pumping. And then more startlingly, that certain areas of the San Joaquin Valley have been lowered 3 feet in just the last 2 years alone. Point being, these are not infinite sources of water underground. They do recharge, but clearly not at the pace at which they're being depleted. Another example that I write about in this dispatch a little bit later on in the water section, in the Rio Grande River, the fourth longest river in the United States, authorities monitoring it recently said that that river probably won't even make it out of Colorado into New Mexico this summer, not even talking about Texas or Mexico, where huge areas in those states are relying upon it for irrigation purposes. So we're literally watching major rivers drying up before our very eyes.
Boy. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamail. Dar is a writer with Truth Out, and we're talking about the destruction of the climate and what it means for humanity. Let's talk about this on sort of the other end of things. You have the Arctic, and you talk about this as one of the most powerful cyclones on record happened in the Arctic, and the impact of what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic by itself. It's not isolated and not having any impact on anything else. And I don't think that's a very commonly understood, you know, situation, that what happens in the Arctic is actually basically people all over the world are confronted by the reality of this.
Exactly. We have to remember that all of Earth functions as a single global system. I mean, it kind of comes back to the James Lovelock Gaia hypothesis, which I think is fact. I don't think it's really hypothesis. The Earth is a single living organism, and you know, you can't do something in one part of it and think it's not going to have effect in probably multiple other parts. And so using Arctic sea ice as an example, as it is continuing to diminish in time, which it is dramatically at this point, and we'll certainly be seeing an Arctic free of summer sea ice sometime within the next 20 years at the absolute latest. Those are the most conservative estimates that I've been seeing as of late. Some people are calling for it to happen basically any year now at this point. So once, but even before that happens, once that ice continues to diminish as it is now, it's already changing critical ocean currents and altering wind patterns as far down as the tropics, which will, of course, it's already caused shifting rain patterns there. So if you look at, for example, NASA drought projections up to, I believe, 2089 is the graph that I have pictured in my mind right now. Central America, as far as soil moisture content, the ability to grow food, it's just not there. It is the darkest brown available on the graph. And that's in large part because of what's happening in the Arctic, not even to talk about then other dramatic climate changes that this is causing around the planet, all just from the Arctic sea ice itself melting. Mm.
You know, you go on to talk about that there's no single weather event that's solely attributable to ACD, but that they are driven in part and mostly driven by ACD. And I wanted to talk about that because a lot of people will say, you know, they'll point to like different things, and it's really, it's true. We live in a country where people are purposely kept pretty ignorant of science, and you know, they don't get a chance. They don't really understand a lot of when you're talking about this. They don't understand a lot about what you're saying in terms of how this is impacting what's happening with ACD in certain areas, in certain, you know, in relation to different lakes, in relation to different parts of the world. They still don't see that there's actually, that it's something that is driven in part and mostly driven by ACD is what's happening all over the world in different, and it manifests itself in different ways. Like, for instance, I was really sort of, you talk about the impact on the Earth as a whole, and then you go into talking about some examples like, and I'll probably mispronounce this name, but baobab?
Baobab trees.
Okay. And the bees. And I was telling my assistant producer here about just how stunning that is to think about, you know, everything starting out from where you've been talking about the ferocity of the threat and the depth of it. And then you get down to this and you have these simple things that could actually disappear and would have a major impact on the ability of humans to actually continue living on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. I'm not sure if it's a proper attribution, but Albert Einstein is often attributed with the quote that once the bees are gone, the humans have 7 years to live. That quote is out there as a meme and has been for decades because bees are arguably the single biggest pollinator on the planet, and we all know that they're going away. And there's a study that just came out of Northwestern University, the one you were just alluding to, that is talking about how even minor temperature increases could lead to the extinction of bees across the entire U.S. Southwest in the very near future. And the study showed that in a 2-year period, just barely tweaking the temperature up, they did a simulation and of a slightly warmer future climate, and 35% of the bees died the first year, and when they kept the temperature up, 70% died the second year. So this isn't going to take a long time, is what we're talking about. And so what happens when you remove bees from an entire region of the country? How do you grow food there? Okay, there are still some other pollinators. Humans can step in and do some substituting, but it's very, very clear. You don't need to be a scientist to understand this, that you're not going to be able to maintain the same level of food production that nature does. And when we start taking out critical parts of ecosystems, the entire system is dramatically destabilized. And us being so heavily reliant upon all of these different systems functioning, when they start going away, we are in deep trouble. And this is why it's pretty easy to be quite cynical about what the future holds as far as these climate impacts and how quickly things are ramping up. And as I track it very closely every day, I'm quite cynical about what what the future has in store for us at this point.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it, yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because I kept thinking about, as I was reading your piece, I kept thinking about, you know, okay, you talk about the oceans warming and rising sea levels and what happens to the reefs, and that's really important. But then you also go to another point, sort of diametrically opposite of that. You go to a point that we actually live with more, and it seems more frequently these days, the fires, the existence of these fires that just keep cropping up and destroying hundreds and thousands of acres of land and the kinds of things that they do in terms of burning whole neighborhoods and, you know, all of this stuff, this destruction by fire alone is just, to me, that is directly attributable to the kind of thing that we're talking about going on directly with the atmosphere, with the warming of the planet.
Well, fires are a great example. And again, just going back to you mentioning how I kind of put in the disclaimer, and I try to remember to do that with every dispatch, is you can't ever attribute one single extreme weather event or phenomena only to climate change. There's always other factors. I mean, we've always had wildfires. We always will. Even if we hadn't introduced any CO2 into the atmosphere whatsoever. But what's happening is they are being amped up, and there's ample scientific studies that back this up. They're coming out on an annual basis at this point that the frequency of fires is increased because of climate disruption, human-caused climate disruption, and the intensity and the size of the wildfires. All of those are escalated because of human impact. And so, you know, anyone listening who's been around for a while and kind of watching and paying attention to wildfires around where they live probably can note, I mean, especially in areas like where you are and across the Southwest where they're common, is that not so long ago, maybe even 5-10 years ago, it didn't used to be the case that every single year you're looking at near record numbers of wildfires and or area burned, not enough wildfire firefighters and hot shots, people being stretched so thin, fire season starting as early as it is or going as late. You know, down there in California, you know, you guys are all acutely aware of when Schwarzenegger was governor and saying, you know, there is no more wildfire season, it's year round, and it is. I mean, look at what happened all through last summer up well into Christmas down just in California. So in so many ways, you guys are becoming the poster child in the U.S. of climate impacts, of anthropogenic climate impacts, and wildfires are a really great example. And it's not just down there; it's in other places too. Over in Norway, as we speak, there's wildfires burning out of control far up into the Arctic Circle. There's been wildfires in northern Alaska, up in the tundra. I mean, this kind of thing, maybe it's happened rarely in the past, but the fact that it's happening now almost every year, it's pretty obvious what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're coming up on towards the end of it, but I had to ask you this one question because my assistant producer was talking with me about this earlier, and we were kicking this around, where one common observation of people generally concerned about climate change is that many people confuse weather with climate. And we've also been having these extreme weather events like 120-degree temperatures in Los Angeles. And these extreme events are increasing and are bound to increase. What kind of weather are we talking about if climate change is not only allowed to continue, but continue at an accelerating pace, which is what the Trump-Pence policies actually will do?
Exactly. Well, you know, fundamentally, weather is short-term phenomena. What's happening right now, that's what you see on the news. What's the weather today? What's it going to be tomorrow? What's the forecast for the next week, 10 days? Climate is the long-term sum of that weather. So it's the long, you know, like the long-term, you know, multi-year scale that we're talking about, you know, kind of sum of the weather, if you will. And so when you talk about LA seeing 120 degrees and these extreme types of heat waves and other extreme weather events, these things are all increasing. And again, there's ample scientific studies that anybody can find online anytime they're interested in looking them up that prove that the number, frequency, and intensity of extreme weather events like cyclones, hurricanes, I point to Hurricane Harvey from last summer, or last fall rather, all these things, wildfires, droughts, flooding, all of these are amping up and will continue to amp up as things move forward. This is why not too long ago, I think 3 or 4 months ago in one of my dispatches, I noted how people tracking hurricanes now are playing around with the idea that, you know, Category 5 is the current highest category we have to measure hurricanes. They're talking about making a Category 6 because 5 is just not, it's not doing the job anymore, that they see the writing on the wall and that what's coming is storms that don't even fit into our current category systems.
Mm-hmm. Now, one last question, Dar. You know, we're living in a time where somebody like Trump is sitting up there and doing all kinds of things that very purposely are aimed at, you know, basically it seems they're aimed at consolidating and pushing ahead with all the things that are destroying the planet. You look at Trump and what he's done with the EPA. There's this denialism that produces both what Trump is pushing is denialism. And that's what gets produced or repeated broadly in society. There's a lot of denialism in this. And then there's the hard, cold reality. And I wanted to talk about those two things. You know, the picture of what's going on today with the people that are ruling this country today, and then how that plays into the denialism and the cold, hard reality of where things are going to go if this isn't stopped.
You bet. I always include a section on that because it's such a stark contrast. And in this month, I talk about the fact how four U.S. Republican senators called to halt funding for a climate disruption education program, calling the program propaganda. That's, of course, offset, and that's like the clear example of exactly what we're talking about, these fossil fuel-funded politicians basically just doing the bidding of the giant fossil fuel companies of spreading seeds of doubt and denialism and things like this. And hold that up against two things. You know, you even have the Pope of the Catholic Church coming out and warning recently that if global governments don't take climate disruption seriously, Earth will be nothing more than, he called it, rubble and refuse. And then I ended this dispatch by talking about another study that was the product of a team of researchers from 17 different countries published in another prestigious journal called Nature Geoscience that showed global temperature projections could actually double those that have already been predicted by climate modeling. And this would essentially mean sea levels could be rising by at least 6 meters or more, even if the world meets the 2 degree C maximum temperature rise level that was set by the Paris Climate Accords.
Mm. All right, Dar, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, definitely, man. And I look forward to having you back real soon. All right. So I'll be keeping an eye on all the things you're writing. And when your book comes out, definitely we got to get that and have a longer conversation around that.
It will come out December 21.
All right. Look forward to talking to you again sooner than December 21. Okay.
Okay, sounds
all
good,
right.
Michael.
Thanks.
Take care,
man. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dar Jamal. Dar is a writer for Truth Out, and he has a regularly appearing section on Truth Out called Climate Disruption Dispatches. And you can find that, as I said, at truthout.org. And Dar also has a new book coming out called The End of Ice, and it's forthcoming from the New Press, and it should be out sometime around Christmas. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Well, I'm really happy to welcome to the show our next guest, Catherine Joyce, the author of Quiverful: Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. This is a Christian fundamentalist movement that I have to tell you, when I read this book, and it's a fantastic book by Beacon Press, it's one that people should rush out and read. This is really a very important book in terms of understanding what's going on in the world today, but actually seeing what is being held in reserve and what's being built up in the society. It's a very serious, a very sobering and enraging thing that's going on. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks.
Sure. All right. I want to know how you wrote this book and managed to come out still feeling clean, okay? I can't believe this book is just an amazing, amazing exposure. And really, you dig into this in the deepest way. And I'm really, I can't say enough thank you for the book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It was certainly a very interesting and often affecting experience reporting it.
I like the way you did this. Maybe what we can do is we can start out. I want to talk more in depth about the Quiverful movement itself towards the end of the conversation, as you organized it in your book. But could you give people just a sense, since that is the title of your book, what is the Quiverful movement? And then we can talk about contextualizing that.
Sure. Quiverful is a conviction, a grassroots conviction, that's really turned into a movement in the past 25 years among fundamentalist Christians who believe that any form of contraception, birth control, is anathema to being a Christian, to being a good Christian. They believe that women should, well, Christian women, that is, of course, should open themselves up to receive as many children as God blesses them with, seeing each child as an unqualified blessing, and seeing this stance as really a pro-life purism that will help them win the culture wars demographically.
You start out, and I found this very interesting, because you make the point that some of these fundamentalists have made, but also that's just very real in the world. And you contextualize this by getting deeply into the ideology and the theology behind it, and quoting one of them saying that ideas matter. And it's actually, there is this sort of contextualizing of this movement that I think would be important for people to understand. What is the context in which this movement is occurring?
Sure. Well, this is largely occurring, almost exclusively, I should say, within the homeschooling community. So that is a sliver, but it's an ever-growing sliver. There are conservative estimates that there are between 1 and 2 of school-age homeschooled children in the U.S. right now. And, of course, that encompasses a lot of different ideologies and religious practices and religious beliefs. But by and large, these days, the homeschooling movement is dominated by conservative Christians. So within that culture, this Quiverful theology that is not just the idea of opening your womb up to receive as many children as God gives you, so that would be 8, 10, 12, or in the case of the famous family, the Duggars, 18 children, but also that wives must be submissive followers to the Christ-like headship of their husbands, and that daughters are to be raised in the same mold as that. So this is something that you can go to a homeschooling conference around the country, even in a place like Worcester, Massachusetts, not too far outside of Boston, and hear this sort of theology and ideology being expounded by very prominent leaders and publishers within the homeschooling movement.
Now, one of the things I found really kind of, again, disgusting, enraging, and whoa, what's going on there? You think back and you think about things like the Promise Keepers movements and all this, and then the movement that you're describing, that this Quiverful thing is part of, is actually, you make the point that this is a very testosterone-laden movement that actually views the Promise Keepers as sort of these, you know, emotional wimps, and as based on the promotion of manliness and the absolute total submission of women.
Absolutely. They proudly call themselves the patriarchy movement, and then they see this as a term that should be reclaimed from, you know, an insult used in women's studies classes. Instead, that this is the God-ordained role for men and women, and they go to great lengths to explain how this should work in particular circumstances within the marriage and within society at large, that there are just certain roles that women are not permitted to fill that would put women in a position of unbiblical authority over men. And this is something that is not just limited to the small but I think influential Quiverful movement. This is something that is shared in slightly different language, but really much the same sentiment and heart in huge denominations like the Southern Baptist Convention, which, if you'll remember, Mike Huckabee is a Southern Baptist, and he was a signatory to their 1998 statement that said that wives should graciously submit themselves to the leadership of their husbands. So this embrace of what they call complementarianism and what people more aligned with the Quiverful sensibility, more honestly, I think, called just patriarchy and the patriarchy movement, is something that's really widespread throughout conservative, evangelical, and fundamentalist Christianity.
Can you explain to people a little bit about complementarianism? And because I think it's important for people to understand that this isn't, you know, when you read that, that's one of those words that, you know, it's sort of like,
sure,
you know, very nice sounding. It's like, well, so of course, people are complementary to one another. But this
sure
is actually has a very odious content.
Right. Complementarianism is the term that's used by the Southern Baptist Coalition, which I'm not sure if I mentioned. That's a huge denomination, 16 million members. It's second only to the Catholic Church in the United States as a denomination. And complementarianism holds itself in opposition to egalitarianism. So if feminism is egalitarian, you know, promoting equal roles between the genders, liberalists and complementarians see themselves in kind of prettied up terms as saying that men and women complement each other, that they are equal in the eyes of God but separate here on earth. And as with most separate but equal ideologies or practices, this ends up looking extremely unequal. There have been a number of really kind of appalling comments in the past few years from complementarian leaders, often within the Southern Baptist Church. Reverend Al Mohler, who is the president of their theological seminary, said just God, so Christian couples who want to get married and not have children are in absolute rebellion against God. Another seminary theologian named Bruce Ware was giving a talk in Texas last June, I believe, and he argued that domestic violence is often caused by women being insufficiently submissive to their husbands, and husbands react against that by becoming violent. So I think that there's kind of a lot of appalling ways in which this has played out. But even the more general state kind of normal theology of this is pretty unsettling. There was a big book written by the really kind of flagship organization that promotes this called the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, and they went into explicit detail about the roles that men and women can play in society at large, and really they just wrote out a list of professions that women probably are not appropriate to hold, such as a traffic officer, because she might be in a position of having authority over a man by writing him a ticket, or a high school teacher, a professor, anything of that sort, where a woman is going to be in a position of authority over a man. And you might think that that's just a real kind of fundamentalist fringe thing that you'd only really see in a very far-right church, but this is quite mainstream.
Well, tell me about the Christian Reconstructionist movement, because that seems to be a big part of this whole thing.
Sure. Christian Reconstructionism is a theology that's based on the work of R.J. Rushdoony, who was a theologian who wrote a really kind of encyclopedic body of work called the Institutes of Biblical Law, in which he...
Catherine? We're having a little bit of trouble with you, with some weird interference on your line, so we're wondering if we could call you back on your cell. I think that's what we'll have to do. We will reach Catherine on her cell. And meanwhile, let me tell you, we've been talking with Catherine Joyce, the author of Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. It's a fascinating book detailing this whole movement that is built entirely on the total domination and submission of women. And it's a highly ideological, highly, you know, militaristic. It's just, it's an incredible, you know, movement that's designed to basically... Well, they have a whole world plan in mind as they're doing all this, and we'll be getting into that as we speak with Catherine Moore. Okay, Catherine, welcome back.
Hi, sorry about that.
That's okay. So you were talking about the Christian Reconstructionist movement.
Sure. So R.J. Rushdoony's body of work called the Institutes of Biblical Law advocated what he called a return to an idea of a Christian America that was governed by the laws of the Old Testament. And they went into pretty graphic detail about what that would entail. Pretty famously, they would include stonings for certain offenders, including witches and gay people, and I think unsubmissive women as well. So there was kind of a whole line of offenses that would be worthy of this sort of biblical capital punishment. But more generally than that, they really stressed a return to the land, kind of a retreat from society to build a more pure Christian society, and getting back to the land and having many children. So in a lot of ways, he is one of the forebearers of the Quiverful movement, and he is also one of the forebearers of the homeschooling movement, which, you know, was such fertile ground for Quiverful.
Now I want to ask you a little bit more about the homeschooling movement. You know, I'm just amazed at that you have three chapters on submission, and you have submission of war, you have... The third one is what, the submission and abuse, and the middle one is no greater joy, and they all involve some form of total submission of women to men and to the patriarchy in general, which goes all the way up from government to God. You know, I mean, it's just an amazing mess there, and yet at the same time, I'm reading it, and some of the points you make in there about, and I particularly want to ask you a little bit later about the submission and abuse, because that was just so horrifying. I know that people get very attached to this ideology and it forms the way they think. But they actually have got to train people in this. And I think these Titus II ministries and the importance of homeschooling must play a big role in all this.
You're absolutely right. There, in a lot of ways, this is a very literary movement that people have learned about through reading kind of a great wealth of literature and writing that has been put out by this community. And it's also very much a mentorship movement. The Titus II ministries that you mentioned are a form of women's ministries that are common across evangelical churches and fundamentalist churches and Baptist churches that really stress woman-to-woman mentoring and an older woman teaching a younger woman how to be a good wife, a submissive wife, a loving mother, a good housekeeper, but most of all, a submissive wife. And they take as inspiration for this Paul's advice to Titus in the Bible. So it's Titus 2 is a scriptural reference. And this can look like a lot of things. This can be explicitly one-on-one mentoring. This can be any number of the wealth of biblical womanhood materials that are out there to encourage you in your highest calling as a wife, which is kind of typical language of the movement. Or it could be retreats. It can be groups, women's Bible studies, where women come together and they are kind of taught how to move forward in the faith by the lights of this movement by expanding the way they conceive of their role as a wife and what submission entails. So they may start out very resistant to the idea and then learning from some of these Titus II teachers, of which there are just many, just hundreds and hundreds, and people who were not even well-known, but just local leaders within their churches. And they learn from that what it's supposed to be a conservative Christian wife. This is also, I think, something that relates pretty directly to how children are homeschooled, particularly daughters. In the Quiverful movement, there is a great emphasis on keeping children within the movement, that they see this as a multi-generational project because they have great concern with demography. One of the early books of the movement, which was called Full Quiver, put this question out there to its readers, saying, imagine what will happen if every Christian couple begins having not just six children, not just a quiver that is full of six children, but a quiver that is full of 10 or 12 children. Imagine in three generations, you know, what a sizable majority will have and what kind of influence we'll be able to wield. And so I think following from that, 20 years later, people really consider this a multi-generational imperative, that you have to keep your children within the movement, particularly your daughters, and you have to convince your daughters early on that what they want to do is follow in their mother's footsteps and bear as many children. So homeschooling in these communities is really particularly targeted to teaching the children, and especially the daughters, that they need to follow in their mother's footsteps. To that end, girls' education starts to diverge from boys' education at a certain point in puberty. They start to be taught, you know, more about what the movement would say, you know, their role in the future. Like, they learn the tools for their laboratory, so that would be the kitchen. And they start to focus more on caregiving and child raising and cleaning and housekeeping and cooking and matters of domestic concern alone, while the boys are getting a somewhat more well-rounded, in the traditional sense, education.
Now, when you're saying all that, I can't help but think, especially again, like chapters you have on submission and the different forms that takes, it pounds at you. It's a heavy weight to bear reading about it. And you think about these women who are, I mean, basically have no life of their own, no life at all, except to serve men. And through that, because men are the representatives of God or Jesus on earth or whatever, you know, to serve them. And the inculcation of this incredibly reactionary outlook around things and the acceptance of that. And like I said, it came horrifying around abuse. You know, I also felt as I'm reading this, that these women themselves, when they take up this ideology, there's this whole point about being at war and the cultural war here. And I think this thing about feminism being such a primary target of this whole thing, and even where they criticize to the degree that the mainstream evangelical churches have allowed women to speak in church or something really minor, they look at that as like, this is going too far. And there's a real view that feminism is actually a major enemy. If you don't destroy that, if you don't demolish that, then the entire thing can unravel. Can you talk about that a little?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was a huge point, and it was one of the first things that struck me when I started to do this research. First, as you said, the extremely militant language that characterizes so much writing about Quiverful. they take their name from Psalm 127 in the Bible, which reads, "Like arrows in the hands of a warrior, so are sons born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. He will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gate." So it's starting from there. They're speaking of their progeny as arrows, as weapons of war. And a lot of exposition has been made about this phrase. The earliest, I think, author of the Quiverful Movement was a homeschooling leader named Mary Pride, and she wrote a really seminal book in the movement called Beyond Feminism, Back to Reality, in which she just issued a real kind of call to battle for all Christians that feminism is kind of what caused all of the social problems that people were seeing in the 80s by her light. So everything that was kind of a mark of liberal attitudes towards sexuality or just modern attitudes towards sexuality, so sex outside of marriage, the acceptance of gays and lesbians, birth control, the availability of abortion, divorce, women working outside of the home, all of these things, she said, were direct descendants from feminism and that you had to go back and attack the source. Where she brought the military rhetoric in was in saying that in order to win this war against the world and against kind of the world's representatives in feminism, that the Christian family needed to organize itself as an army, seeing Jesus, obviously, as the general, but then the husband as the earthly leader who's interpreting all of those orders. And the wife had to see herself as a private, probably at the same level as the children. And she had a really interesting quote from that, an army in which the private is willing to submit himself to the greater good of the army is one that stands a good chance of winning. So she really put it in these terms that if you submit to your husband for the greater good, which is what they focus on a lot, if you submit to your husband, you're submitting to God, then you stand a good chance to win this war. And while they speak of it as spiritual war, when we hear the list of things that they're fighting, we can recognize it very easily as culture war, as everything that's occupied the religious right's attention for the past 30 years.
Yeah, I'd say actually they probably don't have a good time with the 60s either, huh? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Catherine Joyce, the author of Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. To me, it's very important because even as this point about feminism and the connection between that and the insistence, the absolute fanatical stuff around biblical literalism, where if you allow feminism, even the slightest hint of feminism, to actually posit a different position for women in society, to question even what is written as the word of God in the Bible, then the entire thing, that whole thing, aside from what the culture was, that whole thing can actually just unravel. And their whole setup can unravel.
Absolutely. And she said frequently, and this is something that other people believe, that you can't be a partial feminist. Like, you can't accept, as they accused the evangelical, the more mainstream evangelical church of doing, you can't accept a little bit of feminism, such as allowing women to speak in church, allowing them to hold some positions of authority, or even minor authority, and, you know, allowing certain personal matters to remain within the family, such as whether or not they're going to use birth control or, you know, whether or not abortion was something that was okay. She said you can't allow any of that without, you know, a total slippery slope slide into radical lesbian feminism.
Exactly. So. We have about 3 minutes, and so let me ask you this one question, because there's also been this, in terms of the militaristic metaphors that they use and the analogies they have, they talk about the womb being a weapon in a demographic war. And you mentioned you have a chapter in your book called The Demographic Winter. And I think it's really interesting, the sense of sort of people getting a sense of the political dimensions of this and the international scope of this. Can you talk about that a little bit in the remaining time we have?
Sure. They like to point a lot to Europe and lower birth rates there in the past 10 years as an example of a contraceptive mentality, their phrase, triumphing in the West. And they say that this is a great threat because they say that if the West stops reproducing itself at high levels, stops having 3 or 4 or 6 children, then immigrants are going to come and fill a population vacuum in the West. And this is probably something that you've heard of, you know, unconnected from the Quiverful movement, but there are a lot of ties between the proponents of both ideas. So they have spoken of the declining population, or rather the falling birth rates, it's not the declining population, in Europe as a demographic winter. So kind of giving this image of an apocalypse of, you know, aging people and no babies. They, you know, they reference movies like Children of Men, and there is a whole host of conservative books talking about this coming Muslim takeover of Europe. And they've gone to pretty great lengths to go to Europe and to try to make alliances with conservatives in Europe who are concerned or have been made anxious about the effects of immigration in Europe, and trying to sell them on Christian right culture war ideas as a solution to their population anxieties. It's interesting, a report just came out this week, or actually maybe this month, saying that most Muslim immigrants to Europe are, in fact, adapting very well to their countries and adopting the values of those countries, so far from it actually turning into this powder keg of race and religious relations. Actually, people are assimilating in the way that communities have always assimilated.
Well, we'll see what the Christians can do about that, okay? Catherine, I want to thank you very much for joining us. A half an hour goes really fast with a subject like this. I'm really, really grateful to you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And we've been talking with Catherine Joyce, the author of Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement, a really great book.
All right. And on that, on the tail of that, I just want to say again that Catherine Joyce, the author of Quiverful, is her book, which is it's being reprinted because its message has become even more urgent today. And so if you didn't read it when it first came out, go get the book, read it, and your mind will be blown and you're going to be searching around for some big answers. All right. Now, I want to let you know that we're going to do something very special today, which is I want to, in the context of everything that we've been playing today, I really thought that it was important for you to hear this particular excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian, okay, from a talk by Bob Avakian. And it's the talk is "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." And this particular clip is called the GTF, the Great Tautological Fallacy. So let's listen to that and we'll be right back.
In confronting and moving to prevent this, one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way and weighing people down is American chauvinism. The disgusting notion that America and Americans are better and more important than everybody else. This is a poison infecting people broadly in this country, even among the bitterly oppressed. And there is a great need for people to break with this American chauvinism. Free yourself from the GTF, the Great Tautological Fallacy. A fallacy, an idea or way of thinking that is false, wrong. A tautology, a round in a circle way of reasoning that asserts something and then claims to prove it by merely asserting the same thing again. So the Great Tautological Fallacy to which I am referring is the notion that America is a force for good in the world, and therefore whatever it does is good, or at least done with good intentions, even if the same thing, when done by other forces, especially by forces opposed to us, is bad, is evil, because America is a force for good in the world. Thus, in the grip of the great tautological fallacy, when one is told by the authorities and government and the media, etc., that North Korea developing a small number of nuclear weapons and a few long-range ballistic missiles poses a grave threat, one does not question. One does not ask why that is a grave threat, while the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States, having thousands of nuclear weapons and the capability to use them anywhere in the world, is somehow not a grave threat.
There you go, the great tautological fallacy. Free yourself from the great tautological fallacy. The great tautological fallacy, a clip from Bob Avakian's talk, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the Name of Humanity, We Refuse to Accept a Fascist America. A Better World is Possible." And you can find that online at revcom.us. You can also find it at Refuse Fascism, and the entire film will be, you can find that there. Plus, you'll find hours of Q&A that are available at revcom.us, all right? And now we have an announcement. Last week, we talked with two members of the Faith Committee of Refuse Fascism about a program they were having, I Am My Brother's Keeper. Well, that program was videotaped, and the video is linked to on my Facebook page. So go there and check it out. It was apparently a very, very moving and important get-together, all right? And now, as we move in down towards the limit here, I want to recommend something that everybody should read. Read a new piece on Rev that's out on revcom.us, okay? On the website revcom.us. It's called 4 Points on the Past Week: Fascist Moves, Talk of Treason, and the Real Interests of Humanity. Trump's summit with Putin, especially coming right after his nomination of a fascist to the Supreme Court and his bullying at the NATO conference, has administered a shock to the established political order. How should those who oppose the outrages of the present system, all of which have intensified under Trump, understand this? And what must be done by revolutionaries in this situation to move things forward? Sisters and brothers, we got big questions to dig into. We got horrifying times, and we've got a lot ahead of us, all right? So go to revcom.us, read the 4 important points. I'll also post that on my Facebook page. That brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my guests, Dar Jamail, Catherine Joyce, and I want to give a shout out to Bob Avakian for all the work that he's been doing and over the years and continues to do, seeking the emancipation of all humanity and ending this madness, all right? If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now. We're going to go out now with a very special song, all right? And it's called Here Is the Rose, and it's from Outer National. So check this out.
When the nighttime hair's loneliness sinks in, you're getting into mischief, I'm listening. I want to hear your thoughts. It all like a hidden web through the walls. You want to go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those eyes. There is a rose out there tonight. Can tell me if my eyes can see, if my ears can hear you whispering to stand there in front of me. There is a rose out there tonight. There is kids in coffins, the night is young, the hour's getting late. We're too far along and we just can't wait. A moment in time, then it is gone. Now wait a second here, something is wrong. Your feet on the ground.